Hello, and welcome to episode 224 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Most of us struggle to ask for help, even when we need it, and even when it would make our lives easier. We often worry about imposing, or looking weak, or being judged. But as writer Jason Pfeiffer argues in a recent article, those fears are often backward. Asking for help, he says, doesn't burden relationships. It can actually strengthen them. Rick, why do you think asking for help feels so difficult for so many of us, even when the evidence suggests we should be doing it more often?
Well, there's so many reasons, and Jason Pfeiffer's piece is really good. I think and he correctly lists many of them. One is that people might say no. We might ask people for help and they might say no. Another is being indebted to them. Like if I ask for help, then I'm going to be asked to give help to you. I don't think this is really a conscious thought. I think it's mainly subconscious. And we just want to portray like yeah, I'm in control of this. I can do it on my own. I think Jason's right. Like, we're much better off asking for help because people want to provide help and it strengthens our relationships.
This is a really, really small example, but it's something that occurred to me as you were talking. A couple weeks ago, like a lot of Americans, we celebrated Thanksgiving. And I was toward the end of the preparation, and I was in charge of the mashed potatoes. And by the way, I have very strong feelings about proper mashed potato preparation that we can talk about later if you'd like. But as I'm finishing this up, I'm talking to Travis's great aunt, who I don't know well, but Judy's a real nice person. And we were just sort of chatting about things, and she saw what I was doing, and, you know, we were chatting about just whatever was on top of mind. And then I realized that I needed more butter because, you know what, Rick? You can never really have too much butter.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, mixing the potatoes, and I could tell the butter was certainly not within reach. But and I turned to her and said, hey, Judy, would you mind? It's just right over there. Would you mind handing me the butter? And of course she did, right? I mean, she's a nice person. And I added the potatoes, and they turned out great. But I think that's like a really small example of her just, we're having a nice conversation. And I'm sure she's happy that other people are doing probably the food prep that she had done for many times in her life and was just happy to be there. But I think in a case like that, people are just like happy to like feel part of the process, right? And she was like, and again, I don't want to make a big deal about this, but like her walking six steps over, grabbing the butter and handing it to me felt like, I don't know if I thought this at the time, but I thought looking back, like, gosh, I'm glad I did that instead of like putting all my tools down and going over there. It made her sort of feel like she contributed in some small way.
This is a great example because here you are, I assume you're kind of standing next to one another,
yeah,
talking in,
yeah,
the kitchen.
And I'm working.
And,
yeah,
and the butter's over there. And if you have to go get it yourself, you have to go around her.
Yes.
So then she becomes an obstacle.
Or she might think, oh, Scott's just real busy. I'm just going to go talk to somebody else.
I'm just in the way.
Yeah.
So how would you rather have people regard you as somebody who's just in the way or somebody who's a partner in this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
A collaborator or, you know, so that you're in it together. And so you're either included or excluded by whether you're helping, right? And so that's a great example. And sometimes it helps us to picture visually like how we are in relationship with one another. And this is like, are you including or excluding people?
And I think that there are, and I maybe not in my potato example, but there are certainly times where people just feel that asking for help is either admitting that they're weak or making or asking someone to do something extra that they may not have time for. I don't know, but I wonder if, and I think this is maybe touched on a little bit in Jason's piece, is that this might be because, you know, as Americans, we're raised to be like individualists and we can do things ourselves and we're entrepreneurial and we don't need others to assist us. And I mean, maybe that's true sometimes, but I mean, you feel strongly and you talked about, you know, on almost every podcast we've done, how community building is important. And I would think that asking others for help, whether it's pass the butter or something a whole lot more important, does help build and strengthen those community ties.
Yes, and it's surprising how bad we are at asking for help routinely. Now, there's a couple things. One I mentioned, like there's this fear of, say, of rejection and so forth, but it's also, it can be more work to elicit other people's help than to do something on your own. This is something I kind of learned the hard way. And I think it's because, you know, so much of our schooling is individual work and we're assessed individually and we're not really taught to collaborate. And then we get like into the work world, into adult life where we need help and I think for some people, especially for certain generations, it's almost looked as shameful if you admit you need help, you can't do it. And that's not it at all. I was serving for a while as an interim president of a local nonprofit. It was an all-volunteer organization, and it had run into real trouble and we're in danger of closing our doors. And so for about 2 years, I was serving as a bridge until we could kind of reestablish the organization. And I just started doing all this stuff on my own. And I realized that I was doing a real disservice. Like I was getting some things done that hadn't been done, but I wasn't building a team that could carry it on. And like, and this is an important role of people in any kind of leadership position, is how do you build a team of people that feels responsible for carrying on the work of the organization? And if you're doing it all on your own, you're not doing that. And I realized that, like, after kind of getting a couple things back on track, what I needed to do is delegate things and ask for help. And even if there was something I could do, I needed to see if somebody else could do it. And now, one of the reasons that was hard is you might be asking somebody else to do something that you know how to do really well and could do quite easily, and it takes you more time to have somebody else do it. Like just the process of asking them and to supervise the activity and everything until they learn what to do, right? But that can be your role sometimes. And I think it's something that many people, the busier they become, the more inward they go, the less they ask for help instead of the more.
There's a story that we'll link to from 2022 where the New York Times summarized a study published in Psychological Science. And that study found that people are far more willing to help than we expect. And I think this is the key. They feel better afterwards for providing that help than many of us imagined. They found a consistent pattern. Those asking for help imagine far more reluctance and irritation than the helpers actually felt. If that's true, and it certainly rings true to me, it seems a little weird that we feel that way, because by definition, if we're worried about how other people are going to feel about us asking for help, but then when we're asked for help and can help, we feel good about that. Why aren't we more aware that when we ask people for help, that they may also feel good about helping?
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? You know, what we do is we feel good about accomplishing, about being useful.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a different feeling than asking for help and helping others to feel useful. Because then, in some way, the more we do it on our own, the more useful we feel, mm-hmm. the more indispensable. So in some ways, it's quite natural maybe just to do more and more. a number of years ago, I had a member. I've got an advisory board for the institute that I run, and what they help is they give advice on our programs, speakers that we invite to the university that are going to give public talks. We do a number of different programs, conferences, and things like that. And I would routinely ask this group, especially when we were kind of building the institute, when it was brand new, like what direction should we be going and like what speakers we should bring in. I would have people like look at videos, a number of different speakers, and say, like, what do you think, who would be best? And then I would follow up on that. After one of the meetings, I had a board member come up to me and he said, thank you. I can't tell you how many boards I've served on over the years. This one, I feel like I'm really being useful. Like, I'm not just sitting and listening to reports. And it struck me, like, why wouldn't you use the people who are there to help? Why wouldn't you use them? Now, one of the things I've noticed is that I probably use the board less well today than I did, say, 20 years ago, because the organization's become much more efficient. Right. And so it's
and probably has a better defined sense of purpose, I would have been.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we become much more like a center board where I'm given, this is what we did, this is what we're going to be doing next month. And I'm not asking them for as much help as I used to. And this is a continual challenge. Like, I want them to be actually like, is it worth their time even to show up? There's a mindset here in that it can be easier to do things without asking for people's help. But it's important, and I think this research is exactly right. People want to help. We ought to always be thinking, how do I build the relationship we have by a kind of interdependency? This is one of my favorite words over the last couple of years, this interdependency. How do we be helpful to one another?
I want to stick in that interdependency thing for a moment and actually goes back to something that Jason Pfeiffer wrote about in his column, and it talks about birthdays. And I never really thought about this, but there was a time not that long ago, I think in the 1800s maybe, where because record keeping was bad, because not everybody could, their calendars were probably scarce in some communities. People didn't have cell phones, in case you weren't sure. That not everybody knew what their birthday was. Maybe they knew what year they were born. They might have even known the season or the month. But could they have said that, you know, July 17th was actually their birthday versus like, yeah, sometimes the middle of July. And it wasn't even like that important. But as society changed and record keeping got better and things like schools started having like you have to be a certain age to enroll in school, this was a bigger, and people started to learn when their birthdays were, and we had things like IDs and all sorts of things we're familiar with today. But there was a conversation around that time, especially around children, as to whether you should celebrate birthdays. And there were some people who believed that, and I guess this is shows that attitudes go back many, many generations, that children, especially young children, were just selfish, and the last thing you needed to do was give them a reason to be recognized and to have people give, you know, have a party and people to bring gifts and sort of have a day focused on your 8-year-old seemed like, you know, not a great way to impart good and raise good future adults. But what Jason points out was that through that process, there was this interdependency that got built where you would, if you're turning 8 and you invite your 10 kids who are around your same age from the community, and maybe they show up and maybe they bring a gift. And yeah, it's a day celebrating that kid's birthday. But then all those other kids are also going to have birthdays over the next 12 months, and they'll probably have a little event, and then they will rely upon the other kids to sort of celebrate their day. And this interdependency, which I think some viewed as a bad thing, really kind of was a good thing. And I think I'm sure both of us, hopefully, have like fond memories of birthdays as children, not only the people who came to celebrate our day, but also going to celebrate the birthdays of those friends of us, of ours, that were in our peer group. This all seems sensible, right? That's sort of like building that interdependency early. And I guess I'm sure you agree with that, but then how do you also separate that from becoming like a transactional thing? Like, well, we spent, Petey, the little boy next door, gave us a $20 gift, so we'll have to buy Petey a $20 gift when it's his birthday. I mean, you don't want it to become that transactional, right?
Maybe not quite that crass, but it's still transactional, and I think that's a good thing. And that was the point of this idea of this social debt that is created by having a birthday party and having people come. Then you have a debt to go to yours. It's a good idea to create conditions in which we feel like we owe something to one another and that we have the ability to repay it. It's not really burdensome, but we have to show up. The trick here is, how do you make birthday parties something that's a matter of like paying respect to one another, honoring one another? We create the debts, but not become so overblown where it's just becomes an occasion for self-congratulation.
It's a spectacle.
As a spectacle. And that was the concern of critics of birthday parties, because birthday parties were not common at the time. We're kind of like the criticism today of participation trophies. Like, why are you getting a trophy just for showing up on the team? Like, shouldn't you get a trophy if you win something? And that was the criticism of birthday parties. Like, why are you celebrating this kid's just being alive? Like, they didn't do anything. They've just been alive for another year. Why are you celebrating that? Doesn't that make them more selfish? Well, I think that could be the case if that was the only thing that we did. But then that kid then goes to another kid's party where the focus isn't on them at all, but is on the other kid. And this is a good thing for us, that we give respect to others. We are shown respect in return. That's a healthy kind of social environment to be in.
The New York Times article I mentioned earlier talked to some experts who suggested maybe some guidelines or a framework, I guess, that how to ask for help responsibly. And one of these ideas is called the SMART system, S-M-A-R-T, which stands for be specific, make sure the request is meaningful, have it be action-oriented, realistic, and time-bound. And I think that, I mean, it's a lot to keep track of every time you ask someone for help, but the one that of those five bullet points that jumped out at me was time-bound, meaning I think when you're asking for assistance with something, like I asked Judy to get the butter from across the room to add to the potatoes, I did it then say, and I want you here the whole rest of the afternoon in case anything possibly comes up that I want to or need that I can't reach. And so don't go anywhere. I'll probably need you again. That would seem like a bad idea. But in this case, it was like, hey, could you take literally 20 seconds and grab something for me so I can make the potatoes taste good? Seems like fine. And I think having that sort of time frame in there makes the person requesting it seem like it's a more realistic request. And also, I think, makes the people who are receiving the request seem a little less... or a little more likely to say yes.
Yeah, these are great suggestions. If you say you are in charge of a group of volunteers or something, and you want willing participation, when you follow these kinds of recommendations, that you're asking for help, but when it's meaningful and it's time bound, it's specific, so people know going in exactly what they have to do. I just helped out with a service organization in a food collection drive the other night. And I knew exactly what I would be doing, when I had to show up, how long it would last. And that makes it easy to say yes. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't asked like, can you show up for help on this day and then no other instruction, and then you don't know what? And here's what I really hate. And many people hate this when they're asked to help with something, but there's no firm goal in mind, and you go there and there's a whole bunch of people standing around because you're not sure what you're supposed to do. And you really want to, if you've shown up to help, you want to be useful and help, and you don't want to be standing around with a bunch of other people for a couple hours just talking because you're not even sure what you're supposed to do. There's nobody in charge and so forth. Could I share a story about I had two grandmothers who approached this very differently.
Please.
I had one grandmother who was very direct. And when she asked me for help, she would say things like, could you come over and help me weed the garden tomorrow, or pull the carrots, or dig up potatoes? It was something like that. I would be like 10 years old. And sure, Grandma, and we'd come over and we'd go dig the potatoes or something. And it might take an hour, a couple hours, whatever it was. But I'd come over and get right to work. And then I felt really proud of it. We'd have potatoes, you know, for Thanksgiving. And I was one who helped, you know, dig them up, whatever it happened to be. I had another grandmother who would never ask directly for help. But she would talk about it. Oh, that garden hasn't been weeded for a long time. You know, like, you know, oh, my back is so sore because, you know, like I was digging potatoes yesterday. And she'd just make you feel guilty for not being around. But in that case, like, you were never sure, like, well, what does she want me to do, and when, and for how long? And it was kind of like there was always a sense of both guilt and being, as I got older, I realized I was being manipulated and I came to really resent it. And so from an early age, I had like in one situation, I was really happy to go help, and I helped a lot more because the requests were direct and specific, and I knew what was expected of me. The other one, like, I didn't really want to be in her presence because all that was going to happen is she was going to make me feel guilty. And even if I did help out, I mowed the lawn or something like that, there would be something else that I hadn't done that I was feeling that I ought to do. And I think we can fall into those patterns sometimes where if we're not being specific and realistic, sometimes we're being manipulative.
And I'd be curious. So, and as we, you know, thinking back to my mashed potato making thing. We've learned today that basically all stories about potatoes have ethical issues built into them. But, you know, Judy handed me the butter. I said, thank you very much. And went back to work because it was a pretty small ask. If you went over and helped your grandmother in the garden and spent 2 hours digging potatoes for Thanksgiving later that year, I'm guessing it was more than just a thank you, goodbye. She maybe made you a pan of brownies or a cold iced tea or something like
that. There were always cookies in the cookie jar.
Exactly.
Freshly baked, yep.
So I guess the question is, how important is the thank you part of that equation? If you ask someone for help and you get what you want, that there is sort of that last part of that workflow that is, you do want to be thanked for that, right? And I guess it should be proportional to the job that was done.
Yeah, and most importantly, it should just be sincere, like a sincere thanks for what was done. And it can be very simple. If you're helping appropriately, you're not doing it for the thanks. You're just doing it because you want to be useful. You do, however, want to be acknowledged, right? You want people to notice that you were helpful.
So if people listening are convinced, and we've convinced them, hopefully, that asking for help isn't a sign of weakness, it's just part of being a human, how do you think if more and more people did that and we built up these sort of relationships where we help someone and then the sort of the implicit expectation was that, you know, they'll be around when we're in need. If that became more routine than it probably is now, how would that make our society a stronger and better place?
Well, I think if we have this, the idea that that Jason Pfeiffer was talking about was the importance of lingering social debt that's created by these birthday parties that we celebrate. That's a good thing overall. So if asking for help becomes more routine, then we create a more extensive notion of this social debt, which if it's all above board and kind of obvious to us, then it's not manipulative. It's just part of healthy community building.
It seems like also that we've talked about plenty of times on this show is that, I was going to say young people, but it's probably all people in many ways, are able to live more independently than they were 20, 30, 100 years ago, that you can sit on the couch and watch any movie you want. You can push a button on your phone and have a pizza delivered. You can be curious about a particular topic in the world and find a good resource on Wikipedia. There's so much of our lives now that we're less dependent on others. And I mean, as I say that, that maybe is one of the parts of our our digital world that maybe we've sort of almost encouraged in digital development, how you can do this yourself. You don't need to rely on, you know, help from others. You don't need a travel agent anymore. You don't even maybe need a cashier when you go to the grocery store. You certainly may not need a banker as much as you used to. There's so much of our lives that has taken out the need for others to help us. Is that probably why when we do need help that we should like be eager to ask or be able to or be eager to give that help because those connections are fewer and fewer all the time?
So we talked a lot in the show about what's happening, our fraying social connections and the decline of friendship. The decline of friendship is largely because we're just spending less time with other people. And so then the question is, well, so how do we strengthen friendships and how do we form more of them? It's spending more time together, but it's spending more time in meaningful activities with others. Now, meaningful activities is generally where we're helping one another on something. So, for example, if you and I are volunteering together on something, we've got some kind of shared task that we're doing that requires a certain amount of time that we're spending together. If we're doing a lot of these things, we're working on projects together, we're helping each other out, we're doing something together, we are eventually probably going to end up being friends. Now, we've been doing this podcast for 200 and how many episodes?
This is number 224. So 223 times we've done this and 223 and a half times.
And it's about like these episodes are 45 minutes in length, but but the amount of time that we spend together to do each one is probably twice that. So maybe an hour and a half for each episode. So we're talking about 400 some hours probably.
I apologize, Rick.
but like what we're doing is we're working together. We're interdependent working on a shared goal.
Correct.
Our knowledge and affection for one another has really increased over these years that we've been doing this.
We've gotten to know each other.
And this happens whenever we're in these helping roles, right? And so I think that the reason that we've got a loneliness epidemic, right, is largely because we're able to do so much more independently. And this is what technology allows us to do.
So everyone should get a podcast.
Everybody should do some kind of activity that requires collaboration with others. And where we see this especially important is people in their 20s and 70s. Like people who haven't fully entered in the workforce or in more like subordinate roles in the workforce or a college age, maybe in the late teens into the 20s. And then people who are retired. Who no longer have defined roles. This is where we find loneliness to be exceptionally high and where number of friendships are declining over the years from what they used to be. And so it's really important in those areas. And this is why I think like volunteering is how you do that. So I'll I've been talking a long time. Let me just share. I mentioned the other night I was participating in a food collection drive. This was I was doing a 3-hour shift with some other people. We were working. We were collecting food that was being delivered at this event downtown. And I was working with a couple of other people. We spent that entire 3 hours in conversation. These are people
that were talking about canned goods the whole time.
We were just talking about one another's life. Yeah. We were talking about, what were you doing? How did you spend Thanksgiving? How are you planning to spend Christmas? And then we got into history and we're telling stories about each other's lives. I got to know a couple of people that I've known casually for several years. I got to know them much better. Next time I see them, we're going to have much more in common, right? That for me, I think for all three of us, we're really strengthened our social connection with one another, but it also deepened our ties to the community, right? You have to sign up and do these things. This is the greatest way to strengthen your social connections is by helping in some way. And you do that by finding out who needs help and then just signing up.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, I bet you have one for me.
Yes, I've got one. And this is directly tied to our topic that we've just been talking about. Let's say that you are in charge of organizing a group of volunteers for an upcoming community event. And you know someone you think would really benefit from being involved. The problem is, he's a difficult personality. And you're not sure the other volunteers would really appreciate spending time with this person. And you're not sure also, it would make your job of organizing this group more difficult by inviting him. So the question is the personal benefit to that person worth the headaches he might cause in having him involved?
The more I thought about it, the more I realized this was a tough question to answer, which I suppose by definition makes it a good ethical dilemma. I guess I'll ask a couple of, maybe one follow-up question. What makes this person likely difficult to work with?
This person has fairly fixed ideas about how things should be done. And so no matter kind of what instructions you want to give the group or what the group decides, will want to do things his way. Now, maybe can be convinced otherwise, but is going to come up with that. Also, doesn't have a lot of social tact. And so, just kind of struggles to interact appropriately with other people. So not somebody who's going to be really rude, but might seem that way to others.
And then maybe the other question I'll have is this is, I'm guessing, you mentioned earlier in the show that you did a 2-year project helping sort of correct a course on a nonprofit group. This is not some 2-year commitment. This may be more close to what you did earlier, is spend 2 or 3 hours collecting food, or this is not a months long commitment, right?
No, this is a 2 or 3 hour deal. It's like serving dinner at a community event or something like that.
So because I think that I would lean more in that case toward encouraging this, we'll call him Fred, difficult, socially awkward Fred, to participate. Because, first of all, there's no guarantee that even if I try to sell this to Fred, that he's going to say yes. So that's step one. But, even if Fred does say yes, that because this, I think everybody sort of behaves differently going into something when they realize that this is time constrained, that this is not somebody you're going to be spending the next, it's not like you work an office job and somebody sits down in the cubicle next to you and you're like, oh, I'm going to be next to this guy for 40 hours a week for the next 10 years. This is a lot different than that. And I think because of that, and because I assume even though Fred may be a little difficult, he's not going to upset the mission of the serving the food or whatever the event is, that I think he could get enough out of it. I think, and we talk about diversity a lot, across this country. I think one type of diversity that's maybe not talked about as much is just people who like approach things differently. And it sounds like Fred's one of those people. And I think it would be good for Fred in this 2 or 3 hour event to see how other people approach things, and probably good for the other people in this group to realize that there are people like Fred out there too. Because again, this was all predicated on the fact that Fred's not going to like be a danger to others or upset the mission or anything like that. He's just going to be kind of a quirky guy. And I think that in a limited term event like that, it's probably good for all involved to say, hey, the world's filled full of people who look and think about things differently than I do. And in case you need a reminder, here's Fred.
Yeah. So let's say you're organizing something. This is a dinner that's going to be served in the church basement.
Mm-hmm.
You might say, okay, Fred's probably not the person who's going to be serving the food
or greet people,
greet people at the door, but he could be washing the dishes.
Yeah.
Right. You find a role if Fred can be a little socially awkward or socially difficult, but I think you're right. Like invite him because he's not going to outright insult people or get into a fight or something.
Or
like
why
that.
Are we doing this? He's not going to ask questions like that. Yeah.
He's just going to have his own way of doing things and that maybe won't get along with others as well.
Yeah. So I think, I guess kind of taking this a step further, one, I think it would be interesting to assume in this scenario that I know Fred pretty well, right? Because I know I'm comfortable enough to ask him if he'd like to participate, and I also know him well enough to know his sort of idiosyncrasies. So I think the conversation about trying to convince Fred to participate in this event would be interesting. He might have questions for me. I think he probably would, like, why should I do this? Or what's it about? Or what's the greater good that's being accomplished here? But, assuming he says yes, I would also be curious to talk to him like a few days later, like, hey, what did you think of that church basement dinner? Did you, we do this every year. Is that something should I let you know next year when we plan that? Or things like, hey, I saw you were back in the kitchen with these couple of folks. What did you think of my friends? I mean, I would just be curious to sort of talk to him after the fact and see, A, what his, I mean, like legitimately think of what he thought of the event. And B, maybe I don't want to, I mean, this I'm, if I'm friends with him, he's not probably a bad guy. Maybe he would say, I've been thinking that, if you do this next year, you should really consider trying this different way to set things up. Maybe, I don't know what operationally you could do different, but they're thinking, and he may have like a good idea or two, right? And say, and whether he participates a year from now, I don't know. But I think getting input from people who view things differently or have kind of a different lens of perspective can also be useful to an organization.
That's a really good insight. And I'll tell you, my wife, Cindy, has spent a whole career of organizing groups of volunteers because she worked for our local church, and she would organize volunteers for a whole bunch of different activities. And she would always be on the lookout for people that were kind of marginally involved and maybe hadn't been invited, and understood the importance not just of sending out a group invitation to who would like to be involved and have a sign-up sheet, but tapping people on the shoulder and say, hey, I've got something I'd like you to do. Would you consider it? Oftentimes, these people that had not been involved very much in anything before would look forward to doing it again the next time because of that follow-up, right? And so I think that's really important. Then sit down with Fred afterwards and say, how did it go? What do you think? Would you be willing to do this again?
How can we make it better?
How can we make it better? Exactly.
Almost every group struggles to find volunteers, right? And maybe if you find somebody who comes from a different place in life, a different background, a different sort of friend group, it's even possible that Fred might be like, yeah, I thought it went well and it was, more fun than I expected. And, I have a couple of friends who you don't even know about who I might want to involve next year. And I think too often any group, whether it's a volunteer group or whatever group of people, when you bring in people with different perspectives or different circles of friends, that not in every case, but in many cases can make that institution a little stronger. And I think just getting different viewpoints, again, assuming you're all committed to the big mission.
The key thing here is like understanding that there are a lot of people that don't know their help is really needed, even though you're asking, you mentioned groups are all looking for volunteers, but they aren't asking effectively all the time. And they need to extend a personal invitation, go up and say, hey, Scott, would you mind helping out in this specific way at this time, right? And be very specific about it, as we discussed. But this personal invitation where people understand that you want them to participate, not just that you need volunteers, you want them. This is really meaningful for people.
Before we close, I want to go back to sort of the recurring theme of this show, which is, of course, potatoes. Do you like mashed potatoes, Rick?
I thought the recurring theme of our overall show is parking.
But it's potatoes. Okay. But you like mashed potatoes.
Yeah, I love mashed potatoes.
I say every year around Thanksgiving that, do you know what the biggest mistake? I mean, the number of, you know, how many Thanksgiving meals are served around this country every year? I would love to know how much time as Americans we waste every year by doing the most unnecessary thing, and that is peeling potatoes. Is the most bizarre thing that we do. And
do you scrub the skins?
I think russet potatoes make lousy mashed potatoes. I am very much on team Yukon Gold.
They have much thinner skins.
Much thinner skins.
And then you don't peel them.
I just wash them well, boil them in a pot, add a bunch of butter, lemon pepper seasoning, take out my hand mixer. And, you know, are they those bright white, perfectly whipped potatoes that you may see? I don't know where you see those, but you may think about from your past. No, because they're better tasting. They're easier to prepare. Do you or your family peel potatoes? I think it's just the most bizarre thing.
Yeah, but because we're often using russets, and that's a mistake.
It is. I think if you're gonna have a baked potato, a russet potato is great.
My favorite potatoes are the small red potatoes.
Yeah, right? I think those are fine too.
With the skins on.
Yeah, right? Those are fine. Yeah, right. That'd be my second choice. I have no criticism for people who are on the red potato side of things, but I still think Yukon Gold are underappreciated when you're doing mashed potatoes. So this is now turned into a cooking segment, but I had to address that before we close because I do have strong feelings about this.
Good. I have equally strong feelings about zucchini, how it should be banished. I wish we could extirpate all zucchini from the planet.
And speaking of, I guess, kind of related, we came home from Thanksgiving with an eggplant from somebody's garden. I'm not even sure what to do with that, but I guess we will find out.
Yeah, you can bake them and or fry them.
Yeah.
They're actually pretty good.
Better than zucchini?
Yeah.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Also, be sure to check out Rick's column. It's always about ethics. It's never about zucchini. And that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.